Welcome back, everyone, to Casting the Net, the official podcast of the Northeast Texas Public Health District, where we seek to untangle the wide net that covers Northeast Texas. Public health is a very wide, general topic, and each episode focuses on a specific department that is housed within NetHealth. Today, we have the director of our Public Health Emergency Preparedness Department, Mr. Russell Hopkins. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to get to participate.
I hope that was a smooth intro.
That was very smooth.
It changes every time. So for everybody listening, tune in to the next one because it'll probably sound different.
So.
It changes every time. Change is the only constant in life.
And that fits public health to a T. You never know what you're going to get into.
Mm-hmm. So with Thomas and I welcoming you to our cozy studio, if you'll just give everybody a intro of who you are and whether you got into public health on purpose or if you stumbled into...
Just kind of wandered in the door. Yeah.
So everybody has a different journey.
Yeah, they do. And it's funny that some of the most dedicated to the big mission of public health come from outside. They've done something else, and that's been my experience.
Mm-hmm.
I am Russell Hopkins. I'm the director for Public Health Emergency Preparedness at NetHealth. And I had a background in healthcare as a paramedic for 30 years and kind of served in all sorts of role from just a ground pounding medic on the ambulance to flat medic to management to teaching to the government side of regulation, things like that. And man, it makes you old in a hurry. Shift work and just the constant, you know, intense nature of that. After a while, my boss, Harold Higgins, who hired me here, recruited me here, came with an offer at a time that I was physically ready to make a change. And so the way he described it was, it's an office job, it's 8 to 5, you take call once a week or so, and no one ever calls. And, and I was like, I am so
it's like
in.
A dream call center position.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the man may have been a little bit on the, you know, deceptive side there.
You sell the sizzle, not the steak.
He did. And within 8 months, we had Gustav and Ike come through.
So before we talk about those gentlemen, how many years have you been a NetHealth employee?
This will be my 17th year.
So 7 years, 17. Level 17.
Level, yeah.
So with 17 years in NetHealth, and then you said you were, before starting at NetHealth, you were a medic for 30 years.
Yeah.
So what made you, or what encouraged you, or what influenced you 40-something years ago to become a medic?
Oh, wow.
So y'all can do the math, y'all listening. I'm not calling out.
No, I think this is very much going to date me because it is very much an answer about the time that it happened rather than something that I could control. I went to work at Texas Instruments making integrated circuits and doing quality assurance on the slices that they built in their manufacturing plant. And
so could you have maybe had any indirect involvement with all those TI calculators that I had to buy when I was in grade school?
The stuff that we were making was higher end than that. Although, yeah, at that time they still made those circuits. But we were doing that was back when Texas Instruments had a defense arm. And
oh,
so
wow.
A lot of it went into that. And it was a much higher quality product. I thought I'd work like that forever. Well, no, the Japanese jumped into that market and sold chips cheaper than we could make them and started getting laid off. And I thought, man, I need a job because I'd get furloughed, work 2 weeks, be furloughed for a month. And you can't pay your bills like that. So I was looking for something else. And a number of my family were firefighters. And they worked, you know, 24 hours. And then they'd have 2 days off. And they could either work at the fire department or another job. Thought, well, that's the way to go for me. And in that training, getting up to, you know, speed to get a job, be certified, you need to be an EMT. And the very first call I went out on as an EMT convinced me I wanted to be a paramedic. Firefighting would be fine if I had to, but I was more interested in focusing on that patient care. And so that's how it led me. And it was really more about global forces on the way we work. You know, during the 80s, there were corporate layoffs, just piecemeal. The malaise of the oil crash here in East Texas contributed to that. It's just that time, I think, really led me into an area where, you know, I never thought about patient care. I always had done, you know, basic veterinary care in the horses and animals at home. Cows, we always doctored them, and it wasn't anything that I thought was a special talent, but I didn't ever expect to do that for a human being and then go out and just go, oh, wow, that opened my mind up to that's what I want to do.
But in some ways, aren't humans and animals the same in that?
Yeah, we are.
Doing the individual patient care. And
Yeah.
Animals have their own temperaments and personalities. And
yeah, their own. Yeah, it was a very much kind of a intellectual exercise that I embarked on. I was like, I just want to be as good a paramedic as I can be, wherever that's at, you know.
So it seemed like you had developed that skill set to transition from what you thought was not going to apply, taking care of animals and transitioning into going into human care.
Or at least I use that as my kind of basic experience of you have to show some sort of compassion. You need to be able to think on your feet if it's an emergency. It really did help me focus on, all right, yeah, I can reduce the number of manufacturing defects in this thing over time. And I was like, you know, ultimately, that wasn't going to satisfy me. And then you throw in with EMS or firefighting, you throw in that adrenaline, and then you're all in.
Sure.
So it seemed like a out of the ordinary choice back then. In my mind, it was like, how did I stumble into this? But I think I was always going to gravitate to some job that had a service role, a compassion role, something that hopefully eased the suffering of somebody. So I see healthcare as much that as public health is.
So you had mentioned your predecessor, Harold Higgins, and correct my knowledge if it's incorrect, but your department, Public Health Emergency Preparedness, didn't exist until 9/11 occurred.
That's right.
That was the development of the overall topic of public health emergency preparedness. Was that even a thought before 9/11 actually happened, or was it
more
of a snap?
It was
the moment 9/11 happened. Then
it was a chapter in the book, literally. It was an annex to an emergency plan of how do you provide, during an emergency, how do you provide medical care. So, yeah, it was always there, but it was never how do you do this on a scale that would incorporate a city like Houston or a state.
So it was more siloed? Like in
the very much how would you respond to a tornado that took out a hospital. That was the thinking back then.
More of a singular event at a singular location?
Yeah.
And what that response would be?
And people have always known that there's going to be a medical concern with disasters and preparedness and making sure. Even 75 years ago, if the lights go out, you know, you got a problem at the hospital.
Sure.
So that's always been part of emergency planning, but taking it to a scale of 9/11 was really the eye opener of, okay, we've got the physical destruction, and then you have the anthrax that was being sent around to the media and to Congress. What if it wasn't anthrax? What if it's something way more dangerous,
mm-hmm.
But treatable, like smallpox? How would we go about protecting people?
I want to kind of get into a geography lesson with everybody a little bit later in the podcast, but I remember that if it was anthrax or if it was ricin, but there was somebody in Henderson County.
Yeah, young man.
They were manufacturing at home and tried to send it
That we had up in near Texarkana, a lady who tried to frame her husband with ricin and was sent it out and convicted of that. The young man over in Henderson County, it was basically a tabletop experiment in his house. The FBI guys told us that this kid was really, really conscientious about the cleanup and do it. He just did it because he could do it. And surprise.
He had the knowledge
went to prison.
Just wanted to do it just to see if he could do it.
Yeah, they convicted him for doing it because it's ricin. But I don't think there was ill intent like the one up in Texarkana. But that stuff does happen. And if it – ricin you have to ingest. But if it was something contagious, like smallpox, there was no real plan for that post 9/11 season. And so that was what Nick Sereny and Harold Higgins looked at when the mitigation efforts started to come out very early, and they put together a proposal for Northeast Texas Public Health District to be the area here where they did all that planning of what the monies were supposed to provide in your base level service for your community. So it was a grant proposal, and they wrote that up and started. And back then, I want to say they had 15, 16 employees in this department. We're literally about half the size of what we used to be. But so much work has been done since that point. We're greater than 20 years out, which is insane to me, from 9/11. But a lot of the basic plans are done, and we have mitigation processes that we can go through, and our chains of command are exercised. So that effort that they started has now become almost a maintenance.
Yeah, because you can afford to have less people because a foundation and a base has been established.
Yeah, and it's incumbent upon us for us to, when there is a change, particularly in personnel, go meet that person, bring them into the fold of, you know, you don't want to meet that person on game day. You want to have had that relationship going on before. So
certainly.
And of course, that's the way in East Texas our culture
operates.
Yeah. We don't all have a lot of resources on our own, but East Texas seem to come through for each other all the time.
Like everybody knows somebody.
That's
like
right.
Like one of those SNL skits. Like you got a Jimmy. He'll fix your refrigerator for $40. Yeah. I don't have Jimmy. I got Steve.
But I think that really touches on, I mean, precisely what emergency preparedness is like you don't start getting prepared when it happens. You prepare
right
beforehand.
Right.
You know, it's like establishing those relationships before that stuff happens.
And
like,
and be ready so you ain't got to get ready.
Yeah.
It's great that I found something that satisfies my internal reward system for doing the job. Back when I was the paramedic, we did transports all the time that were public health related. That should not be, you shouldn't be spending
shouldn't
your
be in
money
in that situation.
Yeah,
that could have been avoided.
Yeah, it was everything from, you know, there wasn't the right kind of safety equipment in the bathtub or the bathroom, and a fall happened to. Diabetes rates or obesity rates, those things in, that I saw back then, public health is addressing now. It's just that when I was a paramedic and went to a diabetic's house, I give them some glucose and wake them up, and they'd say, "Oh, I don't want to go to the hospital or learn anything about my diabetes." But in public health, we can get whole people educated about how to live healthier. So a little bit different reward system, but back then I saw the need for that mitigation up front, the preparedness, the mission to protect and even promote what you're doing, particularly the preparedness role.
So your department has two main categories that we're going to dive into. So one category being disease surveillance and epidemiology. So first, I want to give a shout-out to Samantha and Kendrick and Dusty.
Yep.
Your epidemiological team?
That's them.
Is that the right term to say that?
Yeah.
Say that five times fast, Thomas.
Yeah, that's why we say disease surveillance.
He didn't even try.
I'm not
going to.
All right.
But how you were mentioning with ricin and with anthrax and there's botulism, there's Legionnaires' disease. I mean, there's a literal list that the State Health Department, DSHS, that they update.
Annually.
Is it every January? Mm-hmm. They update it annually of which diseases are reportable, meaning that they are required by testing providers, hospitals, clinics. If somebody presents with symptoms that relate to that disease, they are required by law to report it to y'all, to a health authority in their area. So this kind of goes back to that geography aspect of the counties that are covered by your department. So if you could dive into how and why you cover seven counties and why you don't do disease surveillance for surrounding counties.
Yeah. Well, we are here at Net Health, a health district created by the wishes of City of Tyler, County of Smith, formed us through an act of the legislature in Austin. So we are the health department. Although we are not county or city government, we are our own form of government. Think of it as a public utility district or a school district, that kind of formation. So we can enforce some county code, like Ginger's Environmental Health Department.
Mm-hmm.
And we can accept grants and contracts from state authorities when we can do the job for them at maybe a better cost. And so they geographically looked at East Texas. Their region is administrated through an office here in Tyler, and it covers 35 counties. My seven counties has about 60% of the population, and so it was there was an efficiency benefit for us to take those seven counties, it was originally six counties, to work, and then we accepted Gregg County to do their preparedness and disease surveillance.
So if you can let everybody know, what are these seven counties?
Yeah, so cover? It's Gregg, Smith, Wood, Anderson, Van Zandt, Raines, and Anderson.
Henderson.
Did I say Henderson? I thought I already said. Yeah.
Well, hey, everybody, they're looking at me like I'm like you're the director of your department. Yes. But not everybody knows the names of counties and knows where their city is positioned in their county. So if you can, listen, cities of each of those counties, so everybody know.
Be Emory, Quitman, Longview, Tyler, Palestine, Athens, Canton. So those counties that they're in.
And those communities and
The surrounding
townships around those cities.
We are population based. We're supposed to be whoever is a resident in that county. But our plant, when on the planning side, we do the people who actually come to these communities. We can talk about that separately. But as a community, if somebody came here and got sick in the city of Tyler and then went back home and was treated, that disease would go to their city of residence, even if it was identified that, you know, they came in contact to it here in Smith County.
So what's the guesstimate population of those seven counties?
650,000, as far as I think that was the 2020 census. It's about 1.2 million in the 35 county region.
So a few people.
Yeah, it's a few people.
Or in the words of Robert De Niro,
a little bit.
So is it a fair statement to say your department oversees some of the public health services for 650,000 residents?
Yeah. We do their disease investigations. We are doing their disease when we send out our numbers, we're, you know, trying to be transparent about what's going on in the community. That's our disease surveillance role, is to bring in these numbers, know what that is, so that elected officials, emergency management, physicians, that whole chain of patient interaction that we have with folks is being looked at, so that there's situational awareness. We know, hey, we've got huge number of asthma related to a particular geographic area, or we have a particularly low intensity number of cases of botulism in a specific area of a county, but because it's an environmental exposure, all we can do is make sure that our ER providers recognize it when it comes in, because it's a very fatal disease to an infant. And not every physician sees this as often as we have it, even though it is a very low intensity kind of occurrence.
So what are a few diseases that circulate but aren't required to be reportable? It's like flu is the readily example I can think of, but are there a few others that aren't?
Norovirus, unless it's in a congregate setting, so that, you know, your cruise flu that you get, that's one of the things that you wouldn't, because can literally pick that up off hard surfaces, not food.
Yeah. So before we dive more into that, going back to what Terrence had said, there is a list of communicable and non-communicable, the ones that are reported and ones that are not reported.
Right.
And I'll definitely put a link in the show notes if y'all do want to check that list
out. To the list?
Yeah.
Because it's actually...
The DSHS list.
You know, going down this list, I remember as an intern speaking to... he's no longer employed with Net Health. Shout out Jason Guest-Lewis.
Oh, my bud.
I used to chop it up with Jason and ask him about all the interesting, you know...
It's a shop of horrors.
Yeah.
It's some nasty stuff. It
depends how you look at it. So when I first started looking at that list, I think, man, I would... become a great Scrabble player. Learn some of these names of these.
They're going to tech you, though.
Yeah, there are words that have X's and Z's and Q's that you don't normally see on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But you get into some of those like flesh-eating ones, you know, it's just can get kind of woo.
Yeah.
Get kind of scary.
Which makes you happy that they are on the reportable list, because I want to know if there's a case of that.
Sure.
In my area, in my city. Yeah.
The bacterial meningitis. That's something that if you don't get on today, now, it gets out of hand in a hurry.
I got a spinal tap in high school because they thought I might have had it.
Been exposed.
I was having real bad migraines. I missed like a week and a half of school. I was real dehydrated.
Yeah.
It started as a headache and then it kind of progressed. But they tested me for it. They gave me a spinal tap. And fortunately, you know, came back negative. But they thought that maybe...
Well, and the treatment is... really easy for most of it, unless it's, you know, the resistant kind. But usually you get a big rear end full of Rocephin and you're good to go. And you don't really end up sick. But bacterial meningitis can do worse than kill you, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You can lose limbs and, you know, facial feature is
brutal.
It is brutal. And
so I'm gonna use three movies to reference into some rabbit holes for us to go down. So talking about bacterial meningitis, I always think of the movie World War Z that came out recently with Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And for those of you who hadn't seen the movie, there was a regular person, there was a zombie apocalypse that happens, and there's a kid that has bacterial meningitis that doesn't get infected because the zombies want to infect healthy humans.
Right.
And so when they sense somebody that had that bacterial meningitis, they stayed away from it. So in my pop culture mind, I'm thinking, well, can't bacterial meningitis kind of be a good thing? Like if there is any kind of situation where, is there any virus, any contagion that would be a, Is there a quote-unquote good disease to catch, or are they all bad?
Well, the whole point of that movie was that a smart virus is one that obviously is detected, goes undetected for a longer period of time, like, and that affects hosts that are viable and that are going to carry it longer.
Mm-hmm.
Without they going want to survive
yeah. as right. long as
it's
they
like,
can.
Because I want to spread as much as I can.
Well, I think you can look back at what the flu in 1918 did. It came on in a wave that was, it was pretty severe. And then it got to Europe and then came back to America in a wave that they had no idea what to deal with. There's a place that I visited not long ago up in the mountains in New Mexico that had gravestones of young women and men who were in a special section with their white limestone tombstones that were specifically in that range. And these people were 17 and 18-year-olds, prime of their life, had probably the most robust immune system, and that flu adapted to take advantage of that and turn it against them and kill them specifically.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, you might see COVID, one of the ways of COVID was really particularly hard on infants. and mothers. And then it migrated to, you know, kind of more of the weaker immune systems. And, you know, moms are always going to, or pregnancy is always going to cause an elevated immune system. And if you've got a virus that is mutated to attack that, I can't see that there's, I can't see without manipulation of a virus by man that a disease could benefit you. Do you think mm-hmm. back to how we came about smallpox vaccine is through cowpox, infecting people with cowpox gave them more immunity to smallpox. Then I guess you could say that could be true. But I don't know that that happens in nature. Unless you're just exposed to the virus and you build your own immunity. Yeah. I can't think of any, and this is where the cool part of my job is. I can go to my desk and call someone who knows in public health if that is actually true, but I don't know that there's a disease like that.
I'm confident in saying, right, we don't always have all the answers in public health. We like to educate and empower everybody as best we can, but if we can't provide that direct assistance or that immediate answer, we know who to contact, and that's where mm-hmm. building those relationships
right.
ahead of time comes in,
right.
to where we know how we can work with other agencies, other companies, other nonprofits, because we know, well, I can't answer it, but maybe you need to contact the RAC or your local fire department.
There's an academic on staff who's a virologist, an actual virologist. I can pick up and call her and say, tell me about, you know, this question. Is there any sort of viral infection that would protect you from, I don't know, zombieism?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that's what, you know, gene encoding and, like, basically taking a virus is bad and encoding it. You know, it's kind of how our, you know, vaccines and things work. I mean, there's...
Well, they've done that with mosquitoes.
Yeah.
There's programs.
Yeah, developing sterile mosquitoes.
Yeah, trying to effectively create a demographic bomb of, you know, everything's sterile at that point and you just die out.
Yeah, for y'all that hadn't heard about this, it's an actual thing where they're breeding, is it male mosquitoes or female? I don't know which gender it is, but they're intentionally breeding one of those genders of mosquitoes. I want to say female mosquitoes.
I don't remember.
To make them sterile so that when they do mate, when they do...
They pass that sterile gene on
so that that next generation does not reproduce.
Right.
Or they're culling the population from the inside out, which...
I don't know if it's been successful or not. It's not a story that comes up a lot, but it's an interesting thought to look at where vaccine technology could go with that and where you would be able to take that potentially hemorrhagic kind of virus and turn that into something that is passed on in its host population, a bat or bird or whatever it is, mm-hmm. and the virus just kills itself. That would be ideal for humans not to take vaccine. We give it to a few of the fauna out there carrying as a carrier and let it go out and essentially breed itself out of the population.
Right. God made all creatures, great and small.
And I love bats.
Even mosquitoes.
Oh, I don't know. Well, they do feed the bats.
They feed the bats.
I like the bats.
Everything was created for a reason. The bats got to eat.
Yep. And they do. They, you know, they they do a lot for our farmers, keeping our plants healthy and pest-free as much as they can. Them in my car. I feel like I've killed every insect.
The other category of your department relates to emergency preparedness. Mm-hmm. We kind of touched on a little bit earlier. So those two gentlemen that you mentioned earlier, Gustav and Ike, those aren't actual guys. Those aren't actual people. Those are we joke in our office of not saying the H word.
Nope.
Or not saying the T word.
We got to go through some sort of voodoo procedure to keep that from happening in our anything. We get really superstitious about that kind of.
So these are natural weather occurrences. So by me just saying the names Katrina and Rita, Harvey, that should give y'all an idea. I'm not going to utter the word. But y'all,
Russell's looking at me. Y'all can't see it. I'm ad-libbing it with my mouth. No, we won't say it.
We call it tropical circulation. And we have some of that going on today, don't we? Well, in Florida anyway.
When you have high pressure and low pressure. And they converge,
mm-hmm.
And this swirling effect happens.
So, yeah, that's part of science class in school. You kind of flash back to, I wish I would have listened a little more. To remember stuff like that.
But for y'all listening, we recently bought a home, and I have a sprinkler system now, so I have an actual reason to
watch the weather.
To watch the weather.
To know when you need to water.
But to my understanding, and not to water. Well, to my understanding, it does have a rain sensor.
Yeah.
Built in. So I turned it off the other morning because I wasn't sure if it was going to run or not. You know, this was like 2 days ago. So
yeah, but you drive all over town and look at the people with rain sensors, and it's just running.
Yeah, so that's why I got up and turned it off.
Kind of like that, where the sprinklers are going.
Yeah,
while it's raining,
or sleeting and snowing, and they've got a,
it's automated. Yeah, and then it freezes.
Icy slip and slide.
So I got mine set to run at about 6:20, 6:30, just before the sun comes up, gives it time to get in to where it needs to, and then the. That's ideally what you're supposed to do.
Right.
They say don't water at night, because if you water at night, the water sits for longer than it needs to, and that's how you get fungus and stuff growing, which some funguses are okay. But I got up and turned it off because I was like, nah. Try to keep that grass nice.
We like the meteorologists. They let us know when to water our plants and when not to water, and when to mow, when not to mow.
They're an integral part of our job. Some of the data, some of the plans we have to build require forecasting, weather forecasting. And in East Texas, I would say you would have a lot less of that than you would have along the Texas coast or within a city where you have high density. But it's an issue still that we write plans for. PGP.
So the H word you refer to as tropical circulation.
Yeah.
What do you define the T word? Because of.
Oh, well, Thomas gave the perfect description. It's the high and low circulation that happens when warm rising and cold sinking air and thunderstorms and then.
And wall clouds and all that good stuff.
Yeah. And then you get Dorothy and Toto getting sucked up and. Mm-hmm.
That's when I go to my smallest windowless interior room.
But you had some experience in your hometown.
Yeah.
That was back in 15?
It was 15, yeah. 15. Mother's Day of 2015.
Yeah.
In Van, Texas.
Yeah, can you speak a little bit to how y'all navigated that?
Yeah, so we were leaving work, and Dusty in disease surveillance called and said, "Hey, there's a tornado just passed right in front of me." And I was like, "Nah." She goes, "Uh-huh, it would throwing the
so they said it like it was a stray dog running in front of your
car? Yes, it just passed right in front of my car, and it was blowing it was in a construction zone on 64 at the time. It started that far south and ran for about 14 miles into Van and picked up just north of Van.
So it was on the ground?
On the ground.
For 14 miles?
Yeah.
Yep. Having its own fun.
Doing its thing.
Ripping and roaring.
And it really didn't have a lot to hit. It took down a transmission line, damaged the odd structure here and there. And then when it hit the interstate, as soon as it cleared that, it started really taking aim at infrastructure. So the sewer plant. And then our schools, and then our oil facilities, they all started getting taken out. Two people died, 250 were injured, that they received some sort of treatment, whether that's transport to hospital or treated and released on the scene.
So that was 9 years ago. It feels like that happened longer than 9 years ago.
Yeah.
But did it seem as if those cities and communities, the people that were affected along that 14, 15-mile route, did it seem in 2015 that they had the ability to recover after that event? Because I know the whole term of resiliency and the rural toolkit that y'all have worked on was a product of that after right. that event, but that, before well, that event,
for 2017 and the Van Zandt County that's tornado when the toolkit outbreak, came out. Right. There was a mixed bag in Van because the fact that it did hit the sewer plant, it did hit the schools, meant that we cleared our damage threshold like that, and the Fed stepped in for help. And so there was a lot of recovery for folks who didn't have insurance or things like that. But we lost a ton of kids from the school who checked into other districts when they canceled. Yeah, they were displaced. We received all kinds of help from TISD, Lindale. Our neighbors really helped with the school. The funding being insured and with federal funds, the build back. I think we have some of the prettiest buildings on campus in Van now. And so it was a big spag. By the time the new year started, Van had recovered the kids that had checked out, although they're not the same people, they did move away. And they lost a bunch of housing that would have been low-income, supported kind of housing in Van. It wiped that stuff out. And now housing for people who have difficulty is tough mm-hmm. in that city. So it there are successes in that particular instance, and there are some areas where we didn't recover really greatly. And that leads us to 2017 when we had the 7 tornadoes in Van and way more structures damaged.
Because those
twice so as many people killed.
They went more, there were more tornadoes. It covered more ground.
Some were.
It hit more cities
yep,
than the 2015.
Yep. Killed 4, damaged or injured a very similar number. I forget, but it was very closely related number. Were treated in some way, but it left a lot of folks out of reach of help because we didn't meet our damage threshold, and because the nature of the geography, these people were more rural, they were more elderly, they were more likely to live in a home that they owned that didn't have insurance because they didn't have to mortgage to pay for it, and they were on a fixed income. Hmm. And what we found out was, when they took all the money and all the donations from Van and distributed it, they didn't keep that plan. They just forgot what they did. They distributed all the money and then close that effort. And I think most people would say that they did a really good job and that we did the recovery as best we could. What we found out, though, was we could have done better, and we could have tried to, you know, retain that memory of how do you do this? How do you get up and running so that a jurisdiction like a county can accept funds? Well, there was no recovery group. There, you know, there that planning had not gone into that. So I ended up as the recovery group chair. And help found that group for Van Zandt County. And so we basically didn't have any information on how to do this for rural communities. And we received funding from American Planters Association and CDC. Net Health went out there and put together a symposium and built a toolkit on how do you start, what do you need to know about recovery. And so first thing we did was define that. And I think of this as a fire ground scene. And how would you go about that? Well, you'd have your response and you'd have your first responders. And then finally the last ambulance and the last fire truck would leave. And then you would have a salvage, an overhaul. You'd have cleanup, people, you know, putting things, you know, where they can at least drive down the road or, you know, get the cat out.
Being able to get out.
Right.
To get in and
resume some sort of basic business. But the recovery is what happens 5, 6, 7 years ago or down the road.
As if that event didn't happen at all.
When you have mental issues because you live in a community that went through something horrible like Uvalde. They're in recovery phase now. They've already been through response, salvage and cleanup, building and everything's put back. Now they're dealing with a trauma response. It could very well be, like in Van Zandt County, the big thing was getting people back into safe and secure structures. So it's a little bit of different element, but they all hit in that social determinants of health domains, whether that's your education that you've grown up with, the money that you make, the environment that you live in, you know, is it clean and safe? It really, that recovery really revolves around that. And what we found uniquely in East Texas is that resiliency happens in health outcomes. It really drives, the trauma drives, mental stress drives obesity rates, not to mention, you know.
And it's amazing that last phase never actually ends, you know.
Never actually.
It's kind of like an athlete who gets injured, right? It's like that last phase when you're in therapy. It's like, okay, now you're in the recovery phase. But it's like ultimately that there's not really an endpoint to that.
Right.
You know.
The rehab.
Right.
The rehab or recovery phase should just transition into a new normal. Mm-hmm. And then in that new normal, you are going to have days of clear skies. And that's where you need to do your planning. And that's what my PHEP folks are trying to do. That's what I've driven this department to do, is get in that recovery cycle and start looking at, you know, in 2017, we had interns go to Fruitvale ISD. They had lost their cafeteria. And we went over there, and I think it's third and fifth graders that we worked with, and they developed their own kind of little, with the help of the interns, developed their own kind of little meal plans and things to take home about, hey, these are healthy choices. You know, those kind of things still have to go on, and communities need to be able to pull those resources. And while there's lots of money for ambulances and fire trucks and police officers and things like that, the recovery often gets overlooked. And so one of the consequences we saw in Van Zandt County was people were living in structures that, you know, maybe that was general store in a community 50 years ago and hasn't been occupied since then, that was the kind of places that, that they found themselves because they'd been unhoused. Or they had a hole in the roof and no way to repair it because they're on a fixed income.
So it's not a matter of if, but when.
It's an element of all of our disasters.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't make the damage threshold that, that brings the full force of aid and repair. Mm-hmm.
Well, how you mentioned there's a start and end cycle to this process, but depending on the weather event, depending on the situation for one county or even for one city, that start to end process may be 2 years, but for another city or another county, it may be 10 years.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
For 20 years.
It definitely is circumstantial. And, the fires in the panhandle this year, it burned towns down.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different thing than a flood. And the response is different. I think it was a lot of, agribusiness that took the damage, where residential kind of things are going to be entirely different to deal with. And then you get both.
And it's good for everyone listening to know those wildfires could happen here in East Texas.
Absolutely.
It could happen anywhere. It's good that they haven't. Hopefully they won't, but that's one of the scopes of service that your department provides.
Right.
So if you can give a quick shout out to, you said, your PHEP folks.
Yeah.
Let everybody know who are your PHEP folks in each county.
Well, I've got Paula Thomas up in Wood County, Vicki McAllister. She covers both Raines and Van Zandt County. Taylor Hills over in Gregg County. We've got Jason here in Smith County, Stephanie Walker in Anderson County. And she is also picking up our Henderson County responsibilities. So yeah, it's not a big team that's supposed to do all of these things, but planning is almost a organizing thing than a forecasting doom and destruction. Our planning has more to do about where do you go to get a resource? What is the process? How do you do that so it's done with the most efficient?
And I think that's a really common theme that we find across kind of most departments in public health. It's like, it's not so much the amount of people that are kind of controlling such broad topics. Yeah. It's like the power of being able to bring multiple avenues of resources together efficiently.
Right.
And it's like you're saying, like,
because we have
having a few select few people, but they have to have strength in being able to bring other people together. Yeah. So it's like you can have one person, but they can wield a multitude of people.
So even though we are a government entity and I have people up in these counties that are representing our organization, we do not have any statutory authority in PHEP.
Mm-hmm.
So the efforts that we put into a community have to be community efforts. They have to tell us what they're capable of. If they're going to say we can do a medical shelter in this community, we need to know where the resources are to do all of those things. And then we can do the planning for it, like we've done in the city of Tyler, and bring all the partners together. We can understand where food, laundry, trash, electric, ambulance service, pharmaceuticals assistance, all of those things are going to come from. We can make that a plan. But but the art of it is really for that person to be out and go, okay, I know this person here has got the forklift for me to manage all this, yeah, or the warehouse space for me to store all this.
So these individuals in PHEP definitely need to know their community.
That's why they live in those communities.
Yeah.
And for the most part grew up in those communities. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our reward system, giving back to those people in our communities. They may not see us, may not recognize our job, but when they pat the first responders on the back for being able to take care of a disaster, that pat on the back extends, mm-hmm, you know, down to us too. We're helping these people do their jobs better.
Yeah,
because we can't do all that ourselves.
Sure.
An analogy I'm gonna pitch is y'all are like a chef, like a cook, like a back of the house kitchen employee, where the phrase is, there's a recipe for disaster. Like y'all make the recipes to prevent disasters or to avoid disasters, and how you're mentioning all these resources that you outline, that you make sure are available. It's like an ingredient list. It's like making a recipe.
Mm. Yep.
Y'all aren't creating the full meal. You're having assistance from all the support staff back of the house in the kitchen to make.
Yeah, because
this meal that you're providing.
NetHealth doesn't have 80 nurses to give shots during an outbreak. We have to go find that resource.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the ability to go out and clean up a water well that's been polluted, but we can find that kind of help, and we can do the testing and things around it to make sure that the water's able to be drank, mm-hmm, safely. So pulling together resources is their bread and butter, and the plans are, you know, plans are what they are. They change over time, but that's why we consider the program in maintenance.
And that's another thing I've noticed too in my almost 6 years working in public health, is a lot of people reinvent things when they don't need to be.
Right.
And it's a waste of resources. It's a waste of energy. It's a waste of man hours. If people would just be like, you know what? Let me put my pride away. It looks like you know how to do this well.
Yeah.
Let's just have you, you know, take the lead on this, being that this is kind of your wheelhouse of expertise. And I'll just help facilitate that. But you have a lot of people recreating similar initiatives and similar things when they already exist.
We do.
You know, and we feel like there's a lot of overlap there.
There's a lot of overlap. And then you find a lot of areas that is new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And in public health preparedness, particularly since 2020, that has been trying to, as we identify that list of reportable disease,
mm-hmm,
we're trying to identify the barriers to good health outcomes. And so we're doing things like researching, why don't you get prenatal care, or why aren't you a compliant diabetic with your treatment? Understanding those kind of things has been part of our wheelhouse now, and so it's not just how do we respond in a disaster. It's how do we improve overall health outcomes, so when the disaster strikes, we don't have to spend. It's already been mitigated. Mm-hmm. Their health is already stronger,
mm-hmm,
and you know, if they have 72 to 96 hours before aid reaches them, they don't die in droves from heat stroke or lack of electricity or what have you. So, that's what we hope that preparedness becomes, mm-hmm, is moving from a very intense first responder response that's really, really expensive to more of a prevention model where the return on investment is much better. And I would say there's easy ways to illustrate that. If you look over at the Dutch, you know, you got a whole country. Well, not the whole country, but a considerable part of the country is below sea level and floods. And they have about the same number of drownings as we do having people dying from falling out of bed. That it just is because they put the work into managing where that water goes. And it's because it's in their face every day. They had to do something. But we get such varied issues here in East Texas, from severe weather, but it can also be fire. It can also be disease. It can be just loss of utilities that that people end up suffering or dying.
But using that Dutch example, they identified a situation. They identify ways to solve and avoid that situation from occurring in the future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a good parallel to what you and your department does,
right,
for our seven counties, for our 650,000 that you said in those mm-hmm. seven counties. And mm-hmm. even kind of by proxy that you said there's a million
people in the 35 counties. In region 4 or 5 north, there's like 1.2 million people. So,
because those people coming into those seven counties are affected also, even though they may not reside in those seven counties, but then traveling in and out, whether it's for business or for
and
recreation, visiting family.
If we're looking at, and because we are population-driven, you look at what happens, city of Tyler goes to about 300,000 people a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, during the workday,
during work hours,
for work hours with school back
then,
in session.
But then you bring in a special event like the fair or something is going on. You got even more people.
Concerts, yeah.
Football games on Friday nights,
football games,
Red Dirt Festival, all that.
And you have different risk factors.
We're the medical seat, you know.
And, yep.
You know, so we have the hospitals too. So that's a whole other aspect.
And that works both ways. We have to also watch what's happening with reinfection rates or hospital acquired infections, because you need to clean up your own kind of act first. And if we're sending people back infected from something from the hospital, of course that county's going to have poor health outcomes. Mm-hmm. So healthcare needs to be not the problem in this case, mm-hmm. But where my department comes into that is trying to protect those services from being overwhelmed. You would not send a 230,000 people in Smith County, you would not send them to the hospital if somebody had been spraying smallpox throughout the county. Why you would shut down the hospitals. Mm-hmm. So the plan, you know, we have plans to do that offsite. Those people could, you know, potentially be all treated, at least if everything goes to plan, and it never does. We would treat those people.
That's
within,
part of the plan.
Within 40, yeah. America's,
to expect the plan to not go according to plan.
That's America's part plan. Of the, plan. The whole country's plan forever has been show up and improvise. So
yeah,
but
well, Well, I was going to say that's part of the. You know, we say Snowmageddon. You know, when that happens.
Yes.
We talk about COVID, and it's like, I guess even being in public health as short of a time as I have been, when Snowmageddon happened and everybody was kind of looking around like, I thought you had a plan to address this. No, I thought this person had a plan to address it. It was like, wait, aren't people paid like crazy amounts of money to come up with plans for this kind of stuff. And it's just kind of crazy because you think, I guess from a layman's perspective, it was like, I thought somebody was paid to know about this kind of stuff and be prepared for this kind of stuff or have plans that are made for
the state created a whole organization to deal with that and do exactly that.
Yeah. And then it happens and you're just kind of like, wait, what's going on?
And we know the weather's not the same anymore. You can call it whatever you want to.
Yeah.
But we get different kinds of intensity of weather, and that particular cold, I wouldn't have ever thought that the gas would go off line. But we know it's getting hotter. We know that more people live in Texas and the demand for electricity is going up. They know that. Whether you spend the money up front to repair or to prepare for damage, like burying lines deeper, those kind of things, taking them off poles and putting them in the ground, you could do a lot of things from today to better prepare because you already know it's getting hotter and demand's going up.
Or you have to comprehend you're going to have to pay for it down the line. So it's where you want to make that,
and you may,
that initial investment.
That investment.
Yeah, you may spend less, but how many people are going to be happy with you?
That's kind of the armchair quarterback situation.
Yeah.
Where there's some elements you don't know until 2, 3, 5 years later. Oh, I should have taken care of that earlier when I had the chance or when the opportunity was right or when the prices were better or whatever. That regret element that you have.
And this goes kind of into I'd love to hear your perspective on this too. I don't think we've ever really talked about it too much, Russell, but the notion of you can't necessarily rely completely on your local government or on the powers that be, that there has to be some kind of stake. You know, you should be
personal agency.
Yeah, like pushing.
And want to help yourself as much as you can.
Right. And even in regards to your own health, you know, it's like taking it into your own hands as opposed to relying completely. Because I don't think the system was ever necessarily formulated that way, but you do find people that lean more towards, yes, you can go to the experts who know or who are supposed to know, who are paid to know, to have your best interest in mind. But at the end of the day, you're responsible for you, the safety of your family.
Yep.
So putting that back into the hands of
the people,
of the person,
of the community,
because the grid may go down. And when you pick up that phone call, there might not be.
Might be a dial tone.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't it be?
You know, so
they're in the. You might know that person personally, or you may need that service because your tax dollars has gone to fund it. Why wouldn't it be the same kind of victim of circumstance that you are currently in? Mm-hmm. That tornado didn't distinguish between
I could be in that situation. Like, us as health department employees, we're just as prone to being victim of a weather situation.
We don't live in some special.
Yeah, we're not insulated, incubated, where we have all these resources available to us.
Our employees died of COVID.
Yeah, like we're as vulnerable as everybody else in East Texas.
That personal agency in this case, I almost see that as you have to reach out beyond the personal agency and you have to become a community to deal with it. That is the best way to get plans written. That's the best way to get an assessment done or any sort of research is go to the community and ask and be part of it. And if you live in it, it's just that much easier. But if you're new to the community or it's a question of circumstances are driving a different set of our different cohort of people, you still need that in that whole preparation because all emergencies are local. Could you do anything about the supply chain as an individual in this country during pandemic? Not really. But you coped, you know, you ended up with your eggs and your toilet paper. and we survived. That is our personal agency. Doing it together and doing it better is where the preparedness part comes in.
Mm-hmm. So I think of it like kind of which came first, the community or the family, you know? It's like, well, community is like a group of families.
Yeah.
So taking it down to that more micro level of like starting with like informing, you know, a household of things that they can do, you know, and eventually you get that to spread,
yeah,
you know, where people have a bigger plan.
Yeah.
But it has to go down to that micro level first before it can even get to the scope of everybody's doing this plan.
Yeah. And
that plan needs to be established at a lower level.
And that is so difficult to do with people's lives being
mm-hmm.
so tuned in to their particular interest. Mm-hmm. We think of ourselves as being good at everything, but most people live in a very strict domain of work and family.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily get the benefit of scale. And so when it's not just a family who is prepared, it's a block or a neighborhood or a town or village, what have mm-hmm. you, then that person who is in their own disaster, because again, like emergencies, all disasters are very much personal.
Yeah,
sure.
It's like the airplane crash, you know, put your oxygen mask on first.
Yeah, take care of yourself first. Yep.
So you can help somebody right. else.
And that's...
or you're in a position where you can help somebody else after.
That's where I think community promotes that personal agency, is by providing the resources, because no, I don't have a bulldozer or I don't have a fire truck or what have you, but I know somebody who does. I know somebody who has masks that my nursing home
had extra. Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of, you know, hey, we do have a way to rehouse people in our community because we live in an area that has lots of Airbnb or partially occupied homes. We can temporarily house these people. We can find a community that, like Canton, when we had to rehouse people, that the hotel vacancies, we put them there so that they could get their houses repaired and not live in, you know, a structure without air
or running water
or water and water, yeah, what have you.
Ventilation. So
those are planning things that, done on the sunny days when it's not storming and disastering outside, that's where you get your benefit of personal agency, I believe.
Yeah, so everybody listening, when we have those Chamber of Commerce days where it's, you know, in the 70s, lower 80s, clear skies, the birds are chirping, the butterflies are going, everybody's outside playing in the park,
yeah,
walking your dog, going for a walk, just living life. You know, we're in our offices planning for what ifs. Where y'all are having fun.
Playing out that zombie apocalypse in our...
Not to say we're not having fun behind the scenes. While you're describing your department, Russell, I imagine y'all in the trench coats and the shades and the Inspector Gadget type hat. Like y'all, you're in the crowd. We just can't distinguish who you are because y'all are that undercover that you're... You're not out and about seeking for public acknowledgement.
Well, no, because...
But you know that y'all are doing a good job when...
Because there's so many different communities in this, we really are a force better used behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I feel perfectly comfortable going and, you know, getting in the stuff in my own community. But I've gotten, through training and experience, I've gotten I say I, the department has gotten good at going to communities and helping them get to consensus because they've done that in their own communities. So it,
and that's the recognition that y'all get. That's the
reward
that,
systems.
That warm, yeah, that warm fuzzy inside. Yes, I've
because the you cannot understate how wrong it is to try and go in and say this is the way to do it to a community.
Oh yeah, especially if you don't have any invested stake in that community. Like, who the heck are you?
Yeah.
You know, you got to have somebody from the inside kind of yeah. come in and relay that information. Yeah.
And that back to the personal agency thing, when they see other people in their community exercising their personal agency, I think it's easier for them to also do that. Mm-hmm. And us being able to say, well, honestly, I don't have an answer for you, but I find it, I do know somebody and we can get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a benefit because this is a marathon. The planning and recovery and the mitigation efforts, this is long-term kind of stuff that needs to always go on. Learn from your experiences like Gustav and Ike. Prepare for disruptions like the supply chain during COVID. You can train yourself to do these convening and exercises so that the communities are focused on the work. You can facilitate all that.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a tangent, but I remember personally learning that you can use things other than toilet paper as toilet paper.
Everybody knows that, Terrence.
Well, not during, yeah, not when it happened. Like they're,
nah, like, not, you I'm really not gonna, got to I'm see not some. Bring that story some up.
You really got to see people's real, true personalities come out when you're around a toilet, like a vital, like when we ran out of bread. You know, the different things that ran out.
You
ain't Clorox never been wipes.
You ain't never
when
been
ran
camping.
Out and,
you ain't never been camping, Terrence.
Well, I've been camping, but just. As you were saying, scaling it across the population, not everybody's been camping.
Yeah,
not everybody has been out of toilet paper. You know, those first world conveniences.
Yeah.
That we have.
Yeah,
when you have to do without, when you're forced to do without.
Yeah. Yeah, got to get creative.
But.
Well. We hope that people learn some basic survival skills before.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's kind of the crux of the whole issue, though, too, right? It's like from a perspective of wanting people to be prepared for an emergency, one of the biggest hurdles or one of the bigger hurdles is like even basic common from our perspective, it seems very common and it seems like information that, you know, it's like, oh, you should definitely know to do X, Y, and Z.
Get some cash, get your medicine together.
Yeah, like
fill up your car tank.
Yeah,
buy a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk.
It's almost
but that's not necessarily the world that we inhabit because that's not necessarily not everybody knows that. You know, so it's like
I see it like a game. How long can you comfortably manage not having power? Like if your power goes out at your house, or if you, depending on where you live, you may not have power as part of your day-to-day life already. So
right.
Being out of power ain't a big thing to you, but for somebody that has lived in Tyler or Longview or in a city their whole life and there's a tornado or flash flood or a transformer gets blown because of straight line winds, power lines go out and it's like a game. Like can you comfortably manage or does it feel like you're going to have a panic attack because you don't know if your power is going to be out for 6 hours or for
we know
a day or 2 days.
We know there's going to be a data element that we can look at and determine what that was. So if we were out of power for 5 days during July and August, we could see how many people were transported to the hospital, how many particular – treatment codes were done at, we can tell a lot of things about disasters and things, the impact.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires a intense amount of data to follow along with.
Because it's one thing to get the data. It's another thing to extract information that is actually useful.
What
do we learn from this?
Yeah,
and what can we see here?
I think a good illustration is our botulism issue here in East Texas. We initially were seeing 1 in 2 cases, and it was touch and go for those kids because we had never seen that here before. And there was a delay in getting them. They need to go to Dallas, and they need to have a shot, the big shot that they produce up there. But time is critical, and whether or not the infant is paralyzed or dead is dependent on how quickly that recognition happens and you get them going. And so public health could see what was happening. We could see where it was happening. And we could go to them and then start saying, you're going to see more of this because here's the
expansion.
Proof.
Yep. Yeah, here's the expansion. The data tells us.
The cases are rising. You're going to see this. Recognize this sooner. Make it one of your default diagnoses. Is I need to be on guard for that all the time. If I even suspect it, I need to get on the line to Dallas. I need to get this infant out of here. And that has become the norm. Now that we see the transfer time greatly reduced because they recognize it and understand, oh, you know, I see a person from this part of the county. I want to default, be wary that this might be botulism. So... Yeah, it's a data game, and you really do have to have the analytical skills to be able to intervene. We don't get a whole lot of opportunity to do that, and most of the time it is related to the intervention becomes part of the investigative process for our epidemiologist.
Mm-hmm.
They usually... Hey, you need to get treated for this. And that's how the intervention goes. But so much of what we're doing and planning for now requires data that says, oh, you're going to experience this circumstance, and we've been talking about botulism, and you're going to see X number of cases a year. And if, you know, growth keeps going, you know, instead of 5 years ago, now it's 10
mm-hmm.
that we see each year. That's also on a larger scale. We see one of the preventable hospitalizations in East Texas, the base cause is dehydration. We spend incredible amounts of Medicare, Medicaid money treating preventable dehydration, which secondarily, you know, can lead to bacterial infections and things like that. There's a lot of things that public health is trying to whittle down.
Yeah.
And with the processing of data and understanding what your community is going through.
We got to use your favorite tool, AI.
Oh,
that's a topic for another.
Whether AI is used or not, just that topic of dehydration, I just extrapolated a few of our other departments that have touch points on that dehydration that relates to Community Wellness Department, our Center for Healthy Living, for
WIC.
Blood pressure control, with WIC, with
breastfeeding,
maternal health, mm-hmm. with breastfeeding. End game wise, it relates to our Vital Statistics Department, or a person may, their cause of death may be something else, but that root cause
is dehydration.
Goes back to dehydration. It may not show up on their death certificate. You know, you died of dehydration. No, it's something that sepsis. Was the end result of.
Sepsis killed you or something else, some sort of metabolic imbalance killed you. It's not dehydration per chance, but that could have been the key to preventing, a UTI or something like that.
So as I reach for a bottle of water to drink to make sure, not literally on, to keep myself hydrated, I'm going to start a new question to add into our podcast based on what you just described, Russell. So, first I want to, if this hasn't been done, thank you for your 17 plus years of service.
Thank you.
At NetHealth. Thank you for public health. Sometimes is included in that term first responder, and sometimes it's not. I don't know if it depends on the department or depends on the type of service, whether
depends on
we're
that.
Wrapped in as being a first responder.
Depends on what kind of disaster you're dealing with.
But if we could transport ourselves in time, with your 17 years of experience at NetHealth, what would you say to Russell Hopkins, to the Russell Hopkins that started 17 years ago at NetHealth, knowing what you know now, being in public health, doing emergency preparedness response, disease surveillance, if you could go back and talk to yourself 17 years ago, what's been the greatest revelation being a public health employee, or revelations or things that have surprised you over the years, or a really great outcome that you've been able to achieve and realize?
Oh, I think personally it would be the opportunity to have had that long to serve in the role. To feel like I'm doing this for not just my community, but for a lot of people's communities. And so it's satisfied my reward system with the challenges that it is, whether that's through funding or personality or what have you. It's just been all those things that a person would probably look for. Maybe it's a different set of criteria, but you've got a list of things that you could check off and say every part of that matches the measure of my success. And so I think personally that's the revelation for me. The other part, the professional part of it, the job, is so similar to EMS. The realization that I didn't go very far in the nature of the job. You deal with people on their worst day. You interact with them at the time that may be the most stressful or sad, depressing, and there's the times that you feel utterly hopeless to help people, and the consequences is they suffer or die. When you think of the job as supposed to being population health, not my health or your health, but our health, you may forget that those stories are out there, that data can't tell you about. An ICD-10 code at the hospital can't tell you about the heat stroke patient. What can tell you, what you can find out in a community is that was a eighth grader who was practicing football and suffered heat stroke. And you know, because we have failed to plan to take advantage of workouts in the right kind of weather or stopping workouts for safety, those kind of things, is that's the motivation to work hard and try to keep the district's business well funded, well staffed, and it really reminds me a lot of EMS. We, you know, effectively are training our own here at NetHealth. I'm kind of proud of the fact that we hire a lot of our own clients at NetHealth. They make really good advocates, and they are part of the community. They can understand. They can go back and talk to somebody with some authority that we know what you're going through.
Because they've been there, done that personally and professionally.
Yeah.
And they're that ambassador.
And so, yeah, I think that's the best takeaway, because you can get into trust in public health or the conspiracy theories of public health or the battle of funding or legislative priorities and things like that. That's just the job. The meat of public health is those stories of people out there who came together, solved a problem, or knew where a solution or a resource was, and they put that together, and their community improved. And whether that's, well, how do we do sanitation? Ginger's environmental folks are out there making sure people aren't at risk at spending their money on lunch. Those are the stories that are public health, not the CDC is this or that, or policy from the Health and Human Services has changed or functioned. Whatever laws have sunsetted down in Austin, that is all the job. Whether you win some or lose some, again, part of the job. The important part is making sure these communities are pushing forward their own solutions, their own people, who understand all emergencies are local, and that comes back to personal agency again. If they knew that their community stood behind them, it's a lot easier to say, I want you to do this in preparation for that. And whatever it is, whether it's a disease outbreak or a climate event, or a resource, where you have electricity go out, or is it a barrier to something? Does your community have a problem with health outcomes and recovery from disaster because you're rural? People have disparities in their life, and they cope with it every day without thinking of it as, well, that's an unequal thing or that's a disparity, but they understand that. I don't have enough money to
go wherever or pay for this or buy.
I have to decide: do I buy gas? Do I buy groceries? You know, people are making those real world kind of decisions out there, and they do need that sense of community to say, yeah, we can help you tear that down or remove that problem, give you access. and preparedness and planning is where I think you get an opportunity to do that. You may only be able to volunteer, Mercy Corps or the Medical Reserve Corps. If you're volunteering, that part of the community is part of that cleanup process. What do they teach them right off the bat? How to be prepared for themselves so that they can volunteer. So there's different ways of moving this along. You can be more that hands-on person, or you could be more the person who works in that background of, hey, let's get together, and if this happens, we'll know here's the steps we're going to take to solve our problem. So we're moving away from, and maybe AI is another solution to this, we're moving away from typing in our offices with the plans to going out and basically just transcribing communities into their solutions into those plans.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, I mean, I think this kind of, I'm not maybe undercutting the whole episode here by being like, you can plan, but that's just one, you know, this aspect of being prepared. Like the plan itself is just one kind of, it's kind of not ethereal, but it's kind of.
Where the magic happens is where you start accepting some risk.
Yeah.
And understanding that there are limits to what you can actually do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And realizing that there may be limits.
Yeah.
Just because you have a plan doesn't mean.
Right.
You can execute. The plan's a framework.
Yeah.
And like I said. Yeah. The plan has always been show up and improvise.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show up as a group because you've planned to do that, the response is just, I mean, that's the very first thing you do.
And it's better to have a plan, a structure, better to have a plan than not have a plan.
Yeah.
And then try to just do it on the fly.
Yeah.
Because then you can make things worse.
Because it really is a lot of times of, good Lord, this has never happened before. But I have a base plan that gives me an ideal of here's the alarms I need to set off so that people will respond who do have a clue about how to proceed or what type of resources applied to resolving the problem.
Hmm. Yeah,
that's the kind of plans that that have to be maintained.
Sure. Well, we're coming up on 2 hours.
I think that's been a big kink in this net that we were able to untangle in this session. And just, you know, we didn't cover everything.
Oh, my gosh.
No.
Public health emergency preparedness and disease surveillance.
We've recently started doing new kinds of research with academia, which is really exciting. One, because it's revenue for the district, but two, it's giving us new insight on things like how much does it cost to do research in East Texas? Because we've learned that it's a lot harder to do that than what people in an academic setting would realize. If they want specific information from a community, say, those in a prenatal high-risk group, you got to go find them, and they got to be comfortable enough to talk to you. In East Texas, they don't want to do your survey; they want to have a conversation with you. They want you to be part of their community.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good transition for everybody listening. If you have questions that you would like to direct to Russell, or to Stephanie, or Paula, or Vicky, or Jonathan, or Taylor, or Kendrick, or Samantha, or Dusty, to our from what you've listened to today, whether you have a question that's been rattling in your mind about disease surveillance, a question about emergency preparedness, situations that Russell and his department, ways that they can benefit your community. That's what they are set up, that they are established to be a resource to serve you. So if you have questions, if there's info that you would like to request from Russell and his department, if you can send us an email through our website. It's castingthenet@netphd.org. You can find the email in the show notes, or you can go to our website, mynethealth.org, and send your questions and info through our website. This podcast is designed for you, the listener. We want to share as much information about NetHealth and our departments and services to benefit you. As Russell said, every emergency is local. Everything that may happen in the big picture has some type of individualized effect upon you as a person, upon you as your family, upon you as your community. So if a bit of curiosity has popped into your mind after listening to our podcast, we want to listen to you. We want to get your questions and assist you as best we can.
Yeah, we want to thank you, Russell, for stopping by, man. We'll definitely have you back on, because as many of the topics as we have and all the, you know, conversations we've had with other directors, you know, we're closing out 2024, probably a few more episodes, but, you know, we'll definitely have you back, because we have plenty that we can talk about. So
yeah,
we appreciate it.
I feel like we just scratched the surface.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we wanted to do with your first, you know, introducing everybody to PHEP and, you know, epidemiology and disease surveillance, just kind of give a 30,000 foot view, and we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Know? We'll have you back, and we can do some more specific conversations on specific topics. But nonetheless, we appreciate you
stopping
by.
Thank you.